Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, purveyor of Hall's Mentholyptus and Fisherman's Friend. Do you need a lozenge? Are you okay?
No, I'm good.
Okay, good. Me too. Hang on. Okay.
Glad we saved that for on
air. Yes, testing.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. Today, we will look at the issue of doctor-assisted death in this country. It's been the law of the land for a year now, but it seems that access is imperfect across the country, and it's becoming fairly hard for some people to access their hard-earned rights. So we'll talk about that, and then we will welcome Michael Chong on the show as today's special guest. You may know him as a contender in the recently completed conservative leadership race, but he's back to work right now as Wellington Halton Hills MP, and we'll talk to him about the just completed work year in the House of Commons. Or maybe not completed, if you believe some of this friction between Senate and the House, but we're not getting into that this week. First of all, we need to address the tragedy at the Grenfell Tower in London. This is the 24-story apartment building that was consumed by flames in minutes, leaving almost 80 people missing and presumed dead, and leaving hundreds more homeless. And from the sounds of this, Scotty, it seems like this might have been... Or this might be a tragedy that is sadly repeatable or might be repeatable.
Yeah, by the sounds of it today, I did see one report. Initially, it said that they thought that 600 of this type of building may have this type of cladding. Mm-hmm. But it turns out it sounds like they've done some testing in record time. They start off with, oh, that can't be done, oh, this and that. Something like this happens, and somehow immediately, in less than a week, they're able to check all of the buildings to see if they comply. And it sounds like, I saw six, it may be more, that have this same type of cladding that is suspected to have caused it. I mean, anybody who saw the footage the first day looking at the side of that, I mean, you knew that it was going up the outside. It was, and of course... all of the other factors, including one fire escape, no sprinkler system to speak of. It sounds like faulty smoke detectors, if any, and bad advice as to people should stay in their suites. Mm-hmm. A perfect storm of the absolute worst kind. And adding to the injury, I guess, was the fact that the citizens group, the Grenfell Towers group blog, and it made the rounds fairly quickly after that happened. 3-4 years ago, we're saying, you know, we're very concerned emergency vehicles can't access this area. I mean, you just look in retrospect, you know, the hindsight is 2020, whatever, but looking at all that, nothing happened, and yet now we have this. So,
yeah, it's. It seems like there were a lot of warning signs. Someone building inspector called it, it was a high-rise building encased in kerosene. Apparently there are multiple types of cladding. There's the cheap stuff, which apparently Grenfell was covered in, and mm-hmm. then there's the not-so-cheap stuff. Although from what I understand, most places have banned cladding, including the United States, at least on the use of tall buildings. So it seems a bit sketch to begin with. I don't know a lot about fire prevention and coating your building and this. I mean, the cladding, if you don't know, it's supposed to beautify mm-hmm. the exterior as well as add some element of energy efficiency. So I guess to stop from heat from escaping and drafts and that kind of thing. But yeah, it just sounds from all these descriptions about, you know, using cladding and, you know, the different types, it seems like it's just a kind of a sketchy way to both beautify and energy retrofit your home. It seems like a cheap way to go out, which probably shouldn't be terribly surprising considering this was a council estate.
Well, and cheap is the word, and that's exactly what happened here, because it sounds to me like the main reason that they did it wasn't for the energy efficiency. It was to beautify it, so the people right. that are paying millions of pounds for their homes in the Kensington area wouldn't have to look at a 70s tower block. And to see them, They're definitely not the prettiest things. They've done a bit of it actually on campus for local people. If you go look at the towers of Lenox and Addington, the lower one, Lenox building in the north, one of the north residences on campus has what they were calling zinc panels, but I happen to have a closer look at them today, and it's like a zinc coating. So with the way they do this, the cheaping, it used to be cladding was, you know, you can get aluminum siding for your house. That's an example. But they've come up with a process to sort of put a metallic sheen on what's essentially a sheet of plastic. So if you put, the idea is you put this metallic cladding on, it makes it look pretty. Sheet of plastic saves money. It's lightweight. You just go bump, 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 put it on. The problem is if you leave an airspace behind it, there's a chimney effect, and that's what you see in the flames. And I believe it also happened in Dubai, of all places, a very, very wealthy country. There was footage of the building going up there. And you can see it. It's just like, it's not even like a firework, but, you know, like fire writing in the sky, just shooting right up because it always takes that path, you know, air, and you know, there's the fire triangle of air and fuel and, you know, the heat ignition source itself. And that you can tell I've actually taken the fire alarms course. So that's the triple things you need for something like this to happen. And absolutely devastating. And coupled with that, also today or the past 24 hours was announced that one of these, we'll call them the richer blocks of housing that's built in the area, has been pretty much bought by the government to house people from this tower. And some of the reaction is incredible. There's been people chiming in who bought. Now, mind you, these aren't just regular flats. Everything in London is expensive, but I think a low-end one is £1.5 million, up to £14 million. We're talking about this is creme de la creme stuff. People are like, oh, this isn't fair, and they don't have to pay this and that, and we're going to leave. And I think some people are like, yeah, good, go ahead and leave. But, yeah, I mean, talk about it. It's like, oh, there's no money for anything. Then all of a sudden, there's all kinds of money for everything. And, of course, this isn't the only block of its kind. In the UK, there's tons of places and blocks of flats like that. So, and then they've pulled a lot of them down, mind you, and are building, say, we'll call it medium-density housing. But my relatives, and a couple of them still do live in what's called a council house, is... They live in older, it's almost like a semi-detached type of structure. And those were all fairly well built in their day. But I mean, as with anything, as with time has gone along, too, you also see it in housing today, too, that, you know, housing, they'll never have the same materials again, particularly with wood. A lot of it's concrete. But, you know, beyond all that, the repercussions of this, I was of the mind when this happened and over the few days afterward, that the government was going to fall, that it was that, you know, you see people marching on City Hall and and that's still a possibility from this, but it remains to be seen.
That was pretty incredible, just like the sheer anger. It seemed like, you know, for a minute there, the straw that broke the camel's back, and then it turns out the camel wasn't broken so much as like dazed, I guess. And that's kind of unfortunate because, you know, looking at the cold hard numbers, you have 600 potentially 600 other buildings that have this same, let's call it goop on it. And then at least three of them have come back as combustible. And that's just in England proper. That doesn't include Scotland, Wales, or Northern Ireland. So who knows how far flung this problem might be. And it doesn't address, I mean, yeah, it's nice that they've gotten nice homes for the people affected. But it also does nothing for in terms of punishing the company that was managing it, like Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organization, which this wasn't their only building, and have apparently been on a naughty list for fire regulations or for not paying attention to fire regulations, for not having, you know, evacuation plans posted and basically, you know, giving it a lick in the promise. I mean, it almost sounds like they're slumlords, even though Kensington is hardly a slum. But
yeah, they're slumlords of their slums, right?
Yeah, that's,
London is a weird sort of real estate place on Earth. It's, you know, you think Vancouver is expensive, London is like astronomical. I think this is Tokyo, London, they're all up there in terms of just a completely different realm of real estate. And also a lot of the places are empty. I mean, these flats that people are going to move in were empty because they're new, but there's lots of There's lots of crumbling mansions that are just investments for people that nobody lives in because they don't build places to house people anymore like they did in the 70s when this tower block was built. They build it as an investment, and that's when it all becomes like this. And if I understand it right, that the ownership of these buildings has been farmed out. It used to be government. There was a division that handled it. Now this housing authority is sort of an arm's length agency, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the government, although it's directly, it's administered by the government, but it's like anything. It's like, well, we can save money by doing this. We can save money by doing that. We can save money by putting crappy cladding on the sides of these buildings. But I mean, and this is the problem. The key problem is that, and you said about who the repercussions, whatever. No one is going to be punished in this. Disaster after disaster, no one is going to take the fall of this. There'll be lots of finger pointing, and there's upwards of 80 people passed away, many, many more injured. I'm sure there's people that they'll never, ever find. But no one, no one is going to, if anything will happen, it will be the government will fall. Mm-hmm. And there'll be some reprimands, maybe. Of course, there's going to be an inquiry. But this is the problem, is that there are people that were involved in this that will never, ever lose a night's sleep over it, considering what happened. And that's just plain wrong.
So. Including potentially Theresa May's chief of staff, who has basically been accused of not acting on.
The report was on the desk, reports. Right?
Yeah, it was on his desk in his inbox waiting to be read. But there were other things to do, like having a necessary election, so.
And that was something else that came up, too, was the cutbacks in emergency services, of which Theresa May was helping with the orchestration of. So it's like there's less fire department, there's less this and everything. Now, mind you, they pulled out all the stops. You saw that picture of all the firefighters completely exhausted. But that was the thing, too. They're going up into the building, and it was a lot like I'd heard a couple of comparisons to 9/11 in that there was a certain floor they just couldn't go past. Like you cannot do it because it would be you're in jeopardy as well. And it was today on Democracy Now! They'd played, I think it was somebody's Facebook Live that was broadcasting, I guess, from the fire, and they never made it out. So it's just the absolute worst thing. If you check that on our archive, the show plays from 11 to 12, and just harrowing stuff, and it's just brutal. They're waiting for help or trying to get help, but. And it sounded like the woman was trying to coax her children who were out in the hall back into the suite where they were, where it was recommended that they stay. But it was doom, just sheer doom, and the worst possible way. So
it makes you wonder if there's no punishment for something like this. Is there punishment for anything? Because we don't. You mentioned we don't see it to the extent in Canada where in Vancouver, Toronto are quote-unquote hot housing markets, but it's nowhere near as kind of super inflated as it is in London. But there's such a premium on places to live now. I mean, every municipality in Ontario is behind on its social housing priorities and its affordable housing priorities. It's purely an it's like the stock market now. It's becoming that way. Housing is like the new stock market, where there are people who can take part and there are people who can't take part.
And that's the part of the problem, too, is that the players that are involved in that, in my view, that pretty much control how housing is built. Like there were lots of factors 20, 25, 30 years ago leading up to governments getting out of the business of housing, particularly during the Harris years, where it's like, okay, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. I recall he specifically said, we are not in the business of housing. Mm-hmm. So downloaded the municipalities. Municipalities are overloaded, as we've seen and we've talked about in Toronto. It's the same thing. Toronto housing, I don't know if there is a disaster of this scale potentially in the cards, but you see some of these places. It's on the news quite regularly with rodents and all the problems there.
Yeah.
Because the demand maintenance and things aren't being done because it's like, oh, well, that's not my responsibility. That's theirs. It's, the buck just keeps getting passed endlessly. Yeah. And you've still got these places that are, unacceptable for even from a human rights perspective, let alone just.
And municipalities can't run deficits, so there's no opportunity to get ahead of the curve by doing some limited deficit spending, which is what the Ontario government has done for the last 10 years. It's what the federal government is doing now, but that kind of liberty is not allowed for municipalities to get ahead of the problem. And fortunately, I think somebody in the city of Toronto said that the cladding here was not used in any of Toronto buildings. I'm not sure if Canada has banned cladding or not, but...
Well, it wouldn't meet the testing standards. If I understand it right, like, the testing here in North America is they pretty much get a bunch of it and set fire to it. And if it doesn't meet the standards, like... I know, ironically, something like a straw bale house, you can put a flamethrower to that and it won't ignite. But something like this, which is petroleum, essentially, mm-hmm. right, with a bit of metal on it, mm-hmm. It doesn't hit the bar, so it's just not allowed. I think it is on lower-rise buildings, possibly to some limited degree, like maybe, but not 20-odd stories.
It's well, not in a place where, I mean, because I think that was... the ban I talked about earlier, that it's banned on the use in tall buildings. So mm-hmm. when you're getting up on the, you know, the 24th floor, there's not too many ways to get out. But, you know, something like a house, if you're on the second floor, you can theoretically get out a window and not injure yourself too much. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Anyway, here's another cheery issue. It was a little over a year ago that the government passed legislation allowing for doctor-assisted death. I found this acronym this week, the Medical Assistance in Death, MAID, in other words. Mm-hmm. It's been over a year since that was a law of the land. Of course, the Supreme Court had struck it down about a year before that. It seems like it's becoming... I hate to say it, but it seems to be like the new kind of culture war. For years, we had this debate over abortion and who gets access to abortion. I mean, that's still going on, obviously, i.e. Garden of Grace. But, but I mean, this seems to be the new front because, you know, catch your eye on the backside of some buses in town. What do you see? You see the ads about MAID. Mm-hmm. And posted by the same people, Wealth and Area Right to Life. And it seems like... the idea for this topic was spurred by an article for the CBC that seems to be it's a universal right now, there is not universal access.
No, and this is to me, this is highly problematic. Of course, a controversial issue, but part of it is that certain institutions, the faith hospitals, faith-based hospitals, are allowed to. They won't actually allow somebody to have doctor-assisted death in their institution, but they will make a provision and you can be transported somewhere else. Now, what has happened in one case, in the case that was talked about in the CBC, was that somebody who was in, like, agony by the sounds of it and mm-hmm. was on their way and had a horrible transfer because the distance between the institution that was willing to do it and the hospital in question was long.
An hour and a half.
Yeah, it's that long.
Ambulance.
Yeah, just ridiculous stuff. And that's a problem to me it's along the lines of what you're saying about when we were talking about the schools last week, is that if it's publicly funded and this is the law, in my view, they should be obligated to do it. Now, there was another case judgment this week that there was a woman, it wasn't on a religious basis, that is qualified to have MAID. She's 77 years old. She's not terminally ill, but she's not going to recover from her illness. They didn't specify what it was. So she's in decline. She's mm-hmm. in chronic pain. She's decided she wants to go. She has her faculties. But her doctor was concerned that, quote, they'd be accused of murdering this woman. Mm. And this is a medical doctor. No, should know the rules. But they were worried that it was going to come back on them. This happened. So that's not necessarily, it isn't a religious argument at all.
Was that Alberta?
Was it Manitoba? No. I think it was out west. And then there was another one out west. There was one in Manitoba. Yeah. Similar along the lines where this hospital board was probably a bit more progressive for a Catholic hospital and said, well, we'll allow it under exceptional circumstances. Mm. And then they got a new board. And that board decided, no, absolutely not. We're a Catholic hospital. We're not going to do that. That went to a ruling as well. And the government said, yes, we're not going to tell you what to do. So, but I mean, having said that, I think it's 1,300 people have taken advantage of this since. So it's not as if it's not happening at all, that they've made it restrictive, like, as happens with abortion. I think that it's far more difficult because the law is very gray in this country, and in fact, almost non-existent. There's no law. It's just sort of like, well, we'll just sort of look the other way on that. But this specifically says, if you wish this service, you should be able to get it. And I don't think anybody who's taking a nickel of public money should be able to say no. And that's just my opinion. But
yeah, I would agree. The 1300 number is, I find, kind of extraordinary. It sounds high, but you know, perhaps it isn't. I found an article talked about Alberta specifically, and it's about four people a week in Alberta that are taking it. So
that sounds like a lot, yeah.
And apparently their review system apparently doesn't get too many complaints. So it seems like Alberta has
of all places
has sort of thread the needle in terms of how you work the system. Toronto too, of course, because that CBC article mentioned a specific case of a gentleman who decided he was suffering from like terminal lung cancer, decided to end his life. Mm-hmm. There's a Toronto University Health Network that has a kind of a panel to, I guess, to double check on things and make sure, you know, you're of a sound mind and that, you know, you are doing this with the consent and observance of a doctor who will understand the complications and how to how to handle the procedure. And that seems like makes sense. That it should be the way it should be. I mean, that's how it is for most medical procedures. And then on the other hand, you do have it seems to be Manitoba in particular, because there was also apparently there's also legislation that was either just passed or is in the process of being passed in the Manitoba legislature to protect doctors and nurses who don't want to take part, which again smells a bit like a religious means test. You know, well, we're not going to make people do what they don't want. It's against their, you know, religion or moral code or something.
Well, but I believe in the law that you medical professionals can opt out.
Right.
And if there aren't enough healthcare professionals in a particular place that are willing to participate, that's where the problems begin.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's where a lot of medical problems begin
sure.
in this country.
And that also, that almost makes more sense, being able to opt out personally for personal reasons as opposed to an institution.
Right.
So it's like, I was going to say it is a gray area. It's not really. It's black and white for a lot of people. Like if you're sworn to preserve life,
yeah,
at all costs, whatever it is, then if that's your views, it's like, no, we should. I'm not sure what the percentages are of people who recuse themselves from being able to do it, but they should have that right, I suppose. But that, you know, maybe it speaks to the greater failings of our healthcare system, in that there are places where it's like you could see it if it was like way up in the territories or something.
Yeah.
But in, you know, in any major center, you would think, geez, this should be a no brainer, right? It should be like, well, if you want to go. And yeah, what's problematic too is that it's still not, you know, you can't really do it at home, just sort of with your. And that's happened too. It was in the UK where a man, his wife, again, terminally ill and wanted to go. And they I don't even think they've touched upon this there yet. In the UK, the husband essentially killed his wife.
Right.
But he's in his 90s. He's frail, the usual. And I think he got a suspended sentence because he's in his 90s. So he was sentenced. He was charged and convicted of doing this. But they gave him some leeway because it was pretty clear that his partner wanted to go, and there was no room for she wasn't going to bounce back. So we always hear about progressive Europe and the rules, because I think our legislation was based on the European model, the Swiss in particular.
I believe
there were people were going to Switzerland, and
yeah.
So I think it sort of takes some of its frame of reference from that, but it's, you know, it's obviously not identical. But
it's on the cutting edge, and I think that's important to remember. And just to what you mentioned about how doctors aren't. The legislation were designed so that doctors weren't forced to do anything. It just makes it seem redundant to what Manitoba is doing. But if the way you think about it in another way, it is not redundant in that if you're trying to create a kind of moral sort of culture case about it, it's like, oh, well, they're all over the country. There are doctors being forced to do this, when it's not the case. And it seems more political than
There's a gun to their head. Yeah, right. That's the impression that you get. It's like they're just killing everybody. Not true at all.
Right, because on top of that, you have the St. Boniface Hospital in Winnipeg. The board approved that they could do the procedure. St. Boniface Catholic Hospital. All of a sudden, there are 10 new board members who immediately roll back what the board decided. And it's like, well, at that point, you're not making a medical decision. You're making a purely individualistic moral decision. Based on your own morals, and that's kind of what the legislation was at the same time protecting. But you know, you can't use the legislation to legislate. You know, when people have access to something, you can't use your own personal biases to stop other people from accessing it, especially in places like, you know, in Manitoba, where there aren't that, you know.
No.
Plus, some hospitals are few and far between. You know, there are some areas where there is only one hospital. And if you're, you know, stuck in, like that gentleman who had to take the hour and a half ambulance ride.
Yeah.
Poor fellow died before they before they did the procedure. But, I mean, that's the, you know, do no harm part of this is, you know, you're doing tremendous harm by like having people pile onto an ambulance and take hour and a half, maybe 2 hour rides to places that will do the procedure. It's like, well, you're a hospital and it's a procedure.
And that's the thing too. If they're looking for loopholes, there must be a way where they could have a location either nearby or in a non-consecrated place. Because I'm assuming it's the religious tone of the place that is preventing this. Because legally they have to find someone that will do it.
Right.
So it's a massive loophole anyway. It's like, why can't they just? I'm not saying like a tent out in the back, which would just be ridiculous, but no, but I mean, maybe some
also
people,
not sterile.
Maybe for some people that would be preferable. Well, it probably wouldn't matter, right? But for some people that would be preferable to having to have any more agonizing moments than is required. But I mean, this is the thing about religious hospitals too. It's a massive legacy issue, and is that the hospitals originally started in churches, right? Way back, right?
Right.
So it was like a division of the church. It's like, we're going to take care of these people, and that's
well, they were only people who would deal with the poor, so.
And the lepers and whatnot, which is, you know, which is a good legacy, I would say.
Sure.
But with our system, where everybody's paying into it, and it's not like you decide with the school board, like, I'm going to give my money to the Catholic hospital. It's not like that at all.
Yeah,
it's just this is Medicare. It's Canada wide, and we all pay for it. It's like, it really shouldn't be allowed. But that's. I don't know if there will come a day where they will just have to do it, but I think it would be a big, big scrap.
Yeah, and as I said right off the top, my kind of concern is that it's going to be another, you know, dumpster fire, nonstop political debate that's, you know, the same as abortion. And I brought this up the last time I talked to Jackie Jeffs of Guelph Right to Life. It's like, well, it's not like there's a abortion tourism in Guelph where there's a women's clinic on every corner. It's pretty hard to find an abortion in this area.
Do you, just as a bit of an aside, do you know? I honestly wouldn't know where to refer somebody where to go.
Well, the hospital will do it. I don't know if you would need a referral.
No, but if you just want a therapeutic abortion, like Morgenthaler style, we'll say.
I think the closest you could do it is in Mississauga.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to find out more about that. Sorry for a bit of a diversion there, but I think
in London, too, but there's nowhere in KW.
No.
And there's nowhere in Guelph.
Which is surprising. We're pushing, what, 750,000 people in those three, between Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge, Guelph, and all of the little spaces in between.
Waterloo,
it's got to be...
Waterloo region's 500.
Yeah, so we're easily up in 600,000, 700,000. That's ridiculous as well, but...
Yeah.
For another day.
For another day. We're going to take a musical break and bring on our guest, who is Michael Chong, the MP for Wellington Halton Hills. And we're going to talk to him about being a leader and trying to be a leader and how the year went in the House of Commons. And we'll talk about all that good stuff. You're listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Hi, I'm Blenders Bubbly, and I listen to CFRU to hear a mix of local content that I'm not going to hear anywhere else. I'm CFRU, are you?
Tell the good man that gathered, the manslaughter was a crime. but Diefenbaker got him off. He didn't do the time. The battle, it began before they crossed the sea. 17 dead soldiers, Royal Horse Artillery. The battle, it began before they crossed the sea. 17 dead soldiers, Royal Horse Artillery.
And that was a double header from a CD new into the station. That is The Wardens. I believe they're from Alberta. And the first song...
Because you see the buffalo on the front.
That's what it says, The Wardens from Alberta. That song was Troop Train, true story, I believe. And the first song was Government Cowboy, which I think is about being a cowboy in the national park system back in the day. Anyway, lovely CD. I believe they're touring, so check them out. I don't have their... The Wardens. Sleeping Buffalo is the album, so...
Speaking of government cowboys, we are pleased to welcome Michael Chong. You are the MP for Wellington Halton Hills, and you now have a lot of free time on your hands now that you're not running for your party's leadership. So, Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I do want to address that because that's over a year. I mean, for you entered pretty early. It was over a year for you, and you know, coming out of it, it must be a bit weird. I mean, you still have all your MP duties and all the meetings and all the meeting with constituents and things like that, but it must feel like you have all this free time now. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah.
He's a man of leisure now. Yeah, that's right.
We entered the race in early May of 2016, just over a year ago, and it was a 54-week race for us. And it was a very long campaign, but we're very happy with how we did, and we're thrilled that we had the opportunity to run.
I was going to say you should be thrilled. I do wonder if maybe Aaron O'Toole stole a bit of your thunder, though. I think, he's nodding yes.
Well, you know, when you have 14 candidates in the race, it's hard to really break, for anyone to break
Absolutely.
Out. And no one did really break out. It went to 13 ballots before the decision was made. So it really was a wide open race, but it was a fair race, and the parties made a decision.
Seeing Andrew Scheer at work, what have you thought so far? I mean, obviously, you're going to give me a positive review, but...
I think two things. First, I think you've got to give him 6 months to settle into the job.
Sure.
Being leader of the opposition is a big job that involves running two separate offices. One is leader of the official opposition in the House of Commons, which has a budget of some $7.5 million and you know, dozens and dozens of staff, and leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, which is a $20-25 million a year operation. So in order to put new people in place, in order to put your plans and priorities in place, it's going to take 6 months for the new leader to settle in. The second thing I'd say is, you know, he was in the House for the last 2 weeks, and I think he performed quite strongly during question period, holding the Prime Minister to account.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I did want to ask you is, you're in an unusual position because you, when you were first elected, you were in opposition, served with the government for 10 years, now you're in opposition again, gone full circle. But in terms of the differences, just for you as being an MP, what's it like to, you know, to go from the one extreme to the other extreme and then back again?
Well, now that we're back in opposition, it feels familiar. It's where I started in 2004. And, you know, what's different this time around compared to when I first started is that I know how the House works. I have an idea of where, you know, where the weaknesses are of the government, where the strengths are of the government, and how to effectively hold the government accountable. That wasn't something I knew right off the bat when I started as a rookie MP some 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of being in opposition, in terms of how you can be effective, I think when you're an MP in the government, you have being in the government on your side. You can offer, you know, be an advocate directly to the Minister of Finance, to, you know, the Minister of Infrastructure. But being in opposition, what's the difference there in terms of how you can serve your constituents, or is it about the same?
It's about the same. You know, I think it was different 150 years ago when, you know, 200 years ago, you know, Canada is much older than 150 years. We've had legislatures in what we now call Canada since 1758. Mm-hmm. The first legislature was established in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Anyways, that's a bit of a tangent. All of which is to say that I think it's different today than it was, you know, 150, 200 years ago, where patronage and who you knew played a much bigger role in day-to-day activities of government than they do today. Today, we have a professional public service. Mm-hmm. They decide how public money will be spent, what grants will be approved, what applications for infrastructure will be approved. And they do so in a way that's nonpartisan, and they do so in a way that's fair to Canadians living in all regions of the country and in every single riding, whether that riding is represented by a government MP or by an opposition MP.
Mm-hmm. And you pretty much have a region as a riding. The Wellington, Halton Hills, that's a pretty big riding. How do you manage to be... I mean, because all the ridings have roughly the same number of people, yeah, but you go from Fergus to Georgetown, yeah, and all points in between. And you have two constituency offices, which is, I'm not sure how unusual that is, but it's certainly unusual for people here in Guelph, where we were used to having the one,
yeah,
down on Cork Street, which I think has been the constituency office for 20 years.
It just keeps changing hands to members, yeah.
Yeah, we go from Winston Churchill Boulevard and the border of Brampton, Mississauga, all the way up to just outside of Elmira.
Yeah.
So it's a big riding. I put on 40, 50,000 kilometers a year on my vehicle, traveling across the riding. And so, yeah, it is a lot more effort to represent a rural riding than it is an urban riding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are ridings in Toronto and in Montreal and in Vancouver where you could literally walk across the riding in about 15 minutes. You know, so meeting your constituents, attending events are a lot easier in those kind of ridings than it is in, you know, the rural and remote regions of this country.
Yeah. I do want to talk about what's been going on in the House. I especially wanted to address the new rules that the House has passed, that the Liberal government's passed, because I know that is something you've been long interested in. So just your general perspective on what the Liberals have proposed and what will now work in the House of Commons. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think some of what they had proposed was worthy of debate and consideration. You know, I think personally, I believe that we should have a prime minister's question period where once a week for a full 45 minutes, if not an hour, the prime minister is grilled by members of parliament and held accountable. But there were many other aspects of what they had proposed that would have weakened accountability. And I think that was why the opposition put up a huge fight to ensure that they didn't ram through changes that didn't have some sort of consensus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my view is that they're still not addressing the fundamental problem in Ottawa, which is the concentration of power in the prime minister's office. We have a system of government unlike any other in the Western world, unlike any other major advanced democracy, where we have put a lot, frankly, too much power in the prime minister's office, and that's to the detriment of the people's elected representatives. You know, just one recent example, this past week, the prime minister announced the new clerk of the House of Commons. The clerk is basically the head of administration,
right,
of the House of Commons. That person should be appointed by the Speaker of the House of Commons, who is accountable to members as a whole, rather than appointed by the prime minister. Most other Western democracies, in fact, to my knowledge, all other Westminster parliamentary democracies have the Speaker appoint the clerk rather than the prime minister. So that's just one example of how we have concentrated power in the PMO and why I believe the reforms that the government has proposed don't address that fundamental problem.
Mm-hmm. Another one I know you're big on was decorum in the House.
Yeah, I think politics is about passion and debate. I don't, you know, this shouldn't be, you know, tea and scones and afternoon high tea. You know, people are passionate about their beliefs. They're passionate about what they care about, and they should be fighting for those things on the floor of the House of Commons. But there's a difference between passion and debate and the occasional witty catcall and some of the pandemonium that has, you know, has broken out on the floor of the House in recent years. So I think the new Speaker has actually taken some good steps to try to rein in some of the more outrageous behavior in the House of Commons in the last year and a half. And I think the House is much more calm this Parliament than it was in the last.
Really? I don't doubt you. You are there every day. But it, you know, just when you watch it on TV, and maybe it's just because they know they're on TV for those. I mean, on the major news channels like CBC, CTV, mm-hmm. it's, you know, the first couple of questions basically from the leaders, and then but the question period goes on. But just, you know, seeing from those clips. I don't know. It just seems to me that...
it can still be improved.
Sure.
Yeah, look, you know, and it's pretty outrageous that the Prime Minister about a year ago manhandled and, you know,
elbow-gate.
Pushed and elbowed, you know, the Conservative opposition whip and a number of other members of Parliament. So, you know, there's still ways to go. I think there are huge problems with question period. I think, but they go far deeper than just the decorum. I think... The number one problem in question period is that the Prime Minister and party leaders control who gets to ask questions. It's outrageous that in our legislature, party leaders through the whips and House leaders and their staff determine who gets to ask and answer questions. This should be the exclusive prerogative of the Speaker of the House of Commons and not party leaders. What happens in our system is that party leaders through their staff determine who gets to ask questions, and those members who are compliant in doing the leader's bidding, get to ask the questions. And that's not what our system should be all about.
Then can I ask, if you were a leader today, what would question period look like?
Well, what I would do is I would propose a new system. And the new system would be to give at least half the questions in question period back to the Speaker of the House of Commons to allow the Speaker to determine who gets to ask those questions and to give the Speaker the power to also compel government ministers to answer those questions. I think leaving the first several rounds to the leaders of the various parties, you know, should stay in place. But beyond that, the Speaker should determine who gets to ask and answer questions.
It's very rare, though, that power ends up given back.
I know, and it's a problem in the Canadian system. You know, in most other democracies, the trend's been the other way. In the British Parliament, the trend has been to take power away from prime ministers and party leaders and give it to elected members of parliament. So, for example, recently, in the last 10 years, the British have made a number of changes to strengthen the role of elected members and to rein in the power of party leaders and the prime minister. Up till recently, in the British Parliament, the party leaders, through their staff and whips, determined who sat on the various House of Commons committees and who chaired those various committees. Members of Parliament in the UK decided to take away that power from the leader, and now MPs elect committee members. We haven't done that here, and I think those are the kind of reforms that we need to take a look at.
What would it take, though? I mean, you had your own sort of crack at reform, the Reform Act. I don't know how that's been going. I think you can shed some light on that, but in terms of, again, revisiting the idea that you very rarely see power given back. It only seems more taken. But in terms of what it would take.
Procedurally, it's extremely simple.
Yeah.
To reform committees and take away the power of party leaders and the prime minister to appoint committee members and committee chairs and give that power to MPs on a secret ballot would simply require a motion to be passed by the House of Commons. That's something procedurally that is very, very simple to do. Politically, it's another matter.
Yeah.
The question is there political will to do it? And, you know, the power structure in Ottawa is very reluctant to change and very resistant to that change. You know, the Reform Act was something that, you know, we introduced in December 2013. It successfully passed Parliament in June of 2015, and it's now the law of the land. Now, the original bill was amended significantly in order to get it passed through the House of Commons and Senate. But nevertheless, it was a significant achievement and proved that we can reform the system and that public pressure can be brought to bear on members of Parliament and the Senate in order to continue to reform the system. So the Reform Act's currently in place. The Conservative Caucus has changed significantly because of the Reform Act. As a result of the bill, we now elect our caucus chair for the first time. David Sweet, who's a member of Parliament from just south of here in Flamborough Township and in Hamilton, was elected as the caucus chair. We elected our interim leader, the past leader, Rona Ambrose. That was the first time we had done that. Previously, the outgoing leader, Mr. Harper, would have appointed the interim leader.
Right.
This time around, caucus elected the interim leader. And the third thing that's happened is that the Conservative Party leader does not have the power to expel a member of parliament from caucus. Mm. This is also a very big step. So the only way a Conservative MP can be expelled from caucus today is by a secret ballot vote of the majority of caucus. So those are three significant changes that have come about as a result of the Reform Act.
Mm-hmm. And Rona Ambrose, I will admit, did a great job.
She did.
And sorry to see her go.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason why she did such a great job is that she had democratic legitimacy.
Mm.
There was never a sense that there was another power behind the throne.
Right.
Because she wasn't appointed. She was democratically elected by caucus, and she had democratic legitimacy, and people in caucus respected her authority. And I think that's one of the reasons why she was so successful. Obviously, the other reason was that she did a great job.
Yeah, and she managed to stay out of the politics of the leadership race, which I was very surprised. I mean, not that she would purposely get involved, but it would, just given the tenor at times, it seemed you would wonder how she would not be able to get involved at some point, but she kept herself above it, which was impressive.
Well, you know, Rana's time as leader proves a truism about leadership, that often people don't see leaders until they're in that position and until they've had a chance to prove themselves as leaders. And Rana was one of those people that demonstrated that truism.
A lot of people wanted her to take it on full time.
That's right.
Speaking of time, we're running out of ours, but I did want to ask you to look ahead a bit in terms of, I mean, essentially the term is about halfway over now. Mm-hmm. You may end up be going back depending on how things work out with the Senate.
The Senate passed the budget.
Oh, did they? I hadn't had a chance. Okay. Well, that's one less thing to worry about. But in terms of the next couple of years, maybe for yourself, for your writing, your caucus, maybe all the way to the government, what are you looking at trying your hand at?
Well, I think the number one concern of Canadians and the constituents that I represent in Halton Hills and in Wellington County is the economy. Mm-hmm. And the government still doesn't have a handle on an economic plan that will produce growth and jobs. And proof's in the pudding. Last year, we had per capita GDP growth of about 0.7%, which is essentially
stagnant
growth. And so we need a real plan to get this economy moving. We have sluggish growth. We still have high unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have extremely high levels of household indebtedness. People are struggling to pay the monthly bills. They're struggling under extremely high levels of mortgage debt, line of credit debt, and other forms of debt. And we need to get this economy moving to help people service that debt and to get those debt levels down.
That's something I think that goes under the wire, the debt that people are carrying. It doesn't seem to get enough attention. We hear about the job numbers when they're good, when they're bad.
Mm-hmm.
We hear about, you know, what money's going to infrastructure and things. But in terms of, you know, the debt load and people paying through the nose for housing, people paying, you know, huge student loan payments, it's
well, part of the problem is that the government has created the problem with household debt. Because over the last decade and more, the government has, through its mortgage insurance program at CMHC, allowed credit growth to grow at unsustainable rates. And as a result, this has led to skyrocketing housing prices and unsustainable levels of household indebtedness. And so my view is that the government should rein in the mortgage insurance and securitization program of CMHC. And that in turn will lead to more sustainable rates of mortgage credit growth. And it also will moderate housing price growth and ensure that middle-class families can continue to afford to buy a home in this country.
I want to touch on this because you are the one conservative who's spoken in favor of carbon tax.
Mm-hmm.
I know the environment has kind of been a stumbling block in terms of the party reaching out to certain demographics. You came out pretty strong for carbon tax. I know there are other conservatives. Patrick Brown has been doing a lot in provincially in terms of making sure conservatives are on the environmental track. Do you think that the party will be able to circle that square in 2019, that it's going to be a benefit to the party, then it's not going to be the albatross it's been in the past?
I think so. I think clearly the party wasn't ready for a revenue-neutral carbon tax, like the ambitious one I proposed during the leadership race. That said, there's different ways to come forward with the pricing on carbon. You know, back in 2008, the Conservative Party under Stephen Harper proposed a cap and trade system. So there's a multitude of ways to regulate and reduce emissions. And I'm confident that the party will have a credible policy on emissions as we head into the 2019 election.
You heard it here first. Michael Chong, thank you so much for coming in today. If people want to reach out to you, how can they find you on social media, email, whatever?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at Michael Chong MP, and they can always call our Fergus or Georgetown offices. If they Google it, our websites and phone numbers will come back.
Well, thank you again so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And we got to wrap off.
It's a new.
Yeah,
thing.
Let's have a wrap off.
Anyway, welcome to wrap off.
Maybe next week. speaking of next week, we will have Ward 5 City Councillor Kathy Downer in studio, and then we will be joined by Green Party of Ontario leader Mike Schreiner on July the 6th. I'm sure he'll have something to say about the environment. We'll stay. we'll stay connected to you at opensourcesguelph.com. Open Sources Newswire on Facebook at OS_Guelph on the Twitterverse. And you can download our podcast on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or get it through iTunes or Stitcher. And I will be back here Wednesday at 8 a.m. for End Credits, a movie review show. And you can also connect with me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at a place called The Spanner Book. Might be something up this weekend. I don't know.
Provocative
try
tease.
Try and keep my promises. I don't know.
Right, that would be refreshing.
Yes, I try.
See how we run things here? Miss House
tight,
of Commons already?
Tight. I move we adjourn.
I move we adjourn as well.
It's unanimous. There we go.
Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources, and we will see you then.